Right, here we go. It's the Magnificent Seven time. Good afternoon to Richard Fitzwilliams, our movie and film critic. Good afternoon, Richard. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. And so I have to say, as London, I was going around the streets yesterday looking at the fabulous lights and carriages of a most extraordinary Christmas tree. If you wander past Fortnum's, you can admire the amazing imagination that goes into these wonderful Christmas windows. Liberty's similarly have a collection of cardboard animals who are enjoying Christmas.
Fantastic. So are the lights turned on Oxford Street yet?
Well, indeed, Oxford Street, they've most of London, and there's a reason for this. They've got these fabulous angels, beautiful, glittering angels with wonderful, shimmering trains. And it's working wonderfully, and they've done it not only in Upper Regent Street, but also Lower Regent Street, and also in Jermyn Street. The whole capital really does look fabulous. It looks alive, and it's so imaginative.
Lovely stuff. It's magical at Christmas. I remember being around, Covent Garden, and a couple of years ago, and I really enjoyed the decorations there. It's fantastic. Just on a royal note, there's been a few rumours about breakdown relationships between Harry and William. What's your take on it, Richard? Is it paper talk?
I think that what we really see, and this is based around the relocation of Harry and Kate to... relocation of Harry and Meg.
Well, that would have been fun.
The Frogmore Cottage in Windsor. Now, they were expected to be William and Kate's neighbours at Kensington Palace. What has happened, and I think the main reason that it's happened is for reasons of the privacy. The facts are that at Kensington Palace, if you've got children, and Meghan, of course, is expecting next spring, you can be overlooked. Paparazzi can be a nuisance. I think that is the main reason. There do seem to have been ups and downs, and there have been a lot of reports of this. There was a particularly good report by Camilla Tomedy in the Sunday Telegraph about the relations between the duchesses. Because broadly speaking, Camilla helped Kate when she was new to royal life. I think Kate has helped Meghan. But I do think, obviously, in any family you get ups and downs, and obviously there have been some of those too. Now remember also different working practices. Kate and Meghan are so different. You've got to emphasise this, obviously, but equally they're committed broadly to both the same things when it comes to charitable work, but obviously a very, very different future, because Meghan is, of course, the wife of the sixth in line to the throne, and it's very different for Kate, who's one day going to be Queen Consort.
We'll carry it. No doubt the papers are going to get as much out of that one as they possibly can. Today, well, I think before we get onto the movies, let's talk a little bit about two film directors that we've lost. Of a similar vein, even, Richard, over the last few weeks.
Well, yes, I mean, it's particularly sad. Two famous directors have recently departed, and when one thinks of Nicholas Rogue, you've got... he was something of a rogue director, wasn't he? His major films were in the 60s and 70s, and most particularly the psychological thriller Don't Look Now, where Donald Sutherland plays a restorer who has second sight and foresees his own death. And it's one of the most phenomenal films with Julie Christie, the pair, and also the sinister ambience of Venice. The extraordinary way it was shot, including a sex scene where it was beautifully done, but the rumour was that they'd actually made love, and this has been perpetuated. Apparently it said it wasn't the case. The facts are, however, that that was, in my opinion, one of the finest of its type ever made, and that, I think, is the monument to someone who also made The Man Who Fell to Earth and other films. Rogue was a performance, was another, which broke down barriers at a time in the early 70s when barriers were coming down.
Mm. And, of course, Bernardo Bertolucci, we lost as well, and, of course, Tango in Paris must be his most controversial and most famous film.
There's no question that I think in the Me Too era, his last, his reputation, I mean, he was very controversial. He was one of the great Italian directors. If you think of Visconti and Pasolini and Fellini and De Sica, you'd undoubtedly include Bertolucci. But I do have to say that the Last Tango in Paris, I thought, was a film, it was essentially about loneliness, about anonymity, and also sexual isolation. There's no question that it was a powerful film, but what came to light subsequently was, and there's absolutely no doubt, was a notorious misuse of power, which he never, it seems, regretted, and that is clearly something that, whilst paying tribute to his extraordinary genius as a director, there is no question that is absolutely appalling. The Last Emperor is one of these rare films which, well, it had the Oscars. It was nominated for 9 awards and took 9, and it was about the last emperor of China, Puyi, and it was superb. But it's rather fascinating. He was a very political film director. I mean, his Marxism intruded into so much of his work, and for example, The Indictment of Fascism, The Conformist, or the fascinatingly ambiguous The Spider's Web, which I think is two of them, is perhaps my favorite of all the films that he did. They were really remarkable. He worked with Vittorio Storano, the great cinematographer, and I mean, there's no doubt that the two of them, The Sheltering Sky was another one, Capturing the Deserts, John Malkovich and Deborah Winger play a couple who try and rekindle their marriage in surroundings that are very challenging. He was, no question about it, somebody who was very talented and very extraordinary, even in some films like his long epic 1900, or indeed Stealing Beauty, which was, I thought, self-indulgent, were not as good as some of the others. But there's no question, it's a great, great pity, but the controversy over clearly a misuse of power cruelly in Last Tango in Paris will remain with his reputation as well, of course, as his achievements.
That's the case, yeah, absolutely. Right, the movies today, Dan, we start off with a Netflix film. I think this is going to the theatres as well, to the cinemas. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yes, indeed, and I have to say, to Coen Brothers addicts, I mean, this is another really amusing, interesting, fascinating, quirky, idiosyncratic movie, because you can exhaust superlatives of the Coens, because you're never quite sure what to expect. You can get Fargo, you can get No Country for Old Men, you can get Intolerable Cruelty, you can get Gambit, and this is a Western, which is why the Magnificent Seven theme, for once, actually links to a film that we're talking about. It was apparently they wrote these stories over some 2 dozen years. Half a dozen stories set in the West, and it's a Western of sorts, a quirky and very, very strange film, beginning with the singing outlaw who can outgun everyone, or so he believes. Another story dealing with someone who tries to rob a bank and what subsequently happens to him, a prospector searching for gold, a young woman in a wagon train which is attacked by Native Americans, and also subsequently a rather curious stagecoach ride, as well as what happens when you're an impresario and you try and entertain in the West from Hamlet to Hamlet. It's one of those very, very unusual movies, because I've never seen anything like it. I don't think anyone else will have, but I think that those who admire the Coen brothers and the way they make films will like the quirkiness of it, the fact some of it's black comedy, the fact some of it's very touching, the fact some of it's visually fascinating, the wagon trains particularly evoking memories of John Ford and the famous Westerns, A lot of it does. I mean, it's often rather, there's a great deal of pathos in this film. So it's a curious one to, really, it is a curiosity.
Sounds like there's a lot going on in one movie, though, Richard.
Well, I don't think they could possibly have packed in more, but I think they could have given us another hour and I'd have liked it.
Oh, there we are. That's good. It does look very attractive. I mean, I do like Westerns anyway, but this... It looks very well made, and it's piqued my interest enough for me to want to go and watch it for sure.
I think that it will have quite broad appeal, but you never know with an audience when it's as unpredictable as this, because there's some really tragic moments in this, and there's some very funny ones. If you begin with the singing cowboy, and it includes levitation and gunfights, and that's just the first episode. It doesn't prepare you for what's coming. So one of those movies that will keep you on the edge of your seat, whether you're laughing, whether you're feeling sad, or it's a mixture of emotions. It is a curiosity, but I liked it. I'd recommend it.
Okay, well, we needed it after last week's films, Richard. Ratings out of 5, then.
Oh, it's getting 4, definitely.
Lovely. Okay, and finally today, the workshop.
The workshop is particularly interesting. I went to a Q&A with the director, who is Laurent Canté, who won the Palme d'Or at Cannes for The Class, which was a brilliant film. And it's the same trademark realism that makes this film significant for its examination of social and political issues in contemporary France. I mean, it's set in the seaside town of La Curtat, where its major employer, the docks, has only survived after a workers' takeover. And you've got both a certain amount of dereliction in the town. Also nearby, you've got a certain amount of beauty, and natural beauty with the sea. A well-known writer, Olivia, played by Marina Foy, she's supervising a workshop that's the centre of this on how to, or at least to begin with, how to write a thriller, which is attended by half a dozen students from various ethnic backgrounds. Now, what this focuses on, this is why it's such an involving experience, it's a sort of social document. It focuses on an unusual participant in the class, Antoine, played by Mathieu Lucci, and his relationship with Olivier, because we find Antoine is frustrated, he's aggressive towards the others, he hangs out with friends who play rather dangerous games, he seems attracted to right-wing politics in the extreme, and Olivier seems attracted to him. Interest follows, believe me. It's very intriguing.
Like you say, it's a commentary on society today, very very topical. And from watching it, it's a foreign language movie, but it doesn't take you long before you don't take so much notice of the subtitles and pick up on the chemistry between them.
Absolutely, because she's writing a novel, she sees the contradictions in his character, because she sees online, and she looks and observes that he's up to very strange things, and his behaviour's odd, so she thinks that she's going to get something out of it. What she doesn't know is that he and his mates are stalking her, they're watching her at night from her garden, and when she asks him to visit her so she can find out more about him, this brings on and leads to, all I can say is it's a dramatic denouement, which doesn't entirely satisfy or convince. But why I recommend this film is that Canté chose young people with no acting experience, as he did in The Class, except for Marina Foy, who plays Olivier. And this device works perfectly. It's enriched by a bit of improvisation. And one of the themes of the movie is the influence of social media and how it affects our perception of the lives of others. And it contrasts urban desolation and natural beauty. And I thought it was full of fascinating and intriguing insights. And it's a perceptive portrait of alienated youth, I'd say.
Mm. Ratings out of 5 for that one, then, Richard, please.
Well, it's getting 4.5.
Good stuff, good stuff. Well, we've had a successful day. We'll leave it at that. We'll quit while we're winning. Richard, if anybody wants to find you online, how can they do that?
It's www.richardfitzwilliams.com and on Twitter at @rfitzwilliams. And for next week, we've got two of our top actresses. We've got Carey Mulligan opposite Jake Gyllenhaal in Wildlife, and we've got Rachel Weisz in Disobedience, a film, in fact, which was set remarkably where I live in London.
Ah, now, just to remind you, reminded me there, because I've noticed that so many English or British actors that are in Hollywood films, and in that film, the first film we were talking about, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, one of the baddies in there, I only saw a clip of him, but he's actually, you would never know this, but he's full-on Yorkshire. And he actually does the voiceovers for radio stations in the UK as well. He's got a very deep voice, but he's a full-on Yorkshire guy. He used to be in the office with Ricky Gervais. He's done very well. So a lot of British actors doing very well at the moment, again, as always.
Well, they certainly are, but you mentioned Ricky Gervais. I saw a poll which said that over 80% apparently when polled wanted Ricky Gervais to return to the Golden Globes as host.
Ah.
Heaven forbid.
Absolutely. I agree. I do like him in some stuff, but I just didn't in that at all, Richard. No way. Right. Richard, I need a bit of homework, if you can do some for me. And that is a couple of Christmas movies. What do you reckon, the next few weeks?
Certainly will. Absolutely delighted to think about the ideal movies to see at Christmas. We can discuss them.
Richard, thank you very much. We'll speak soon. You take care, my friend.
Great.
Cheers. Pleasure.